what God did do was to say, I will give you elders to serve, to bear the burden of leadership with you. And that's what happened. There were 70 elders chosen, and the Spirit of God came. He assembled them before the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. The Spirit of God came upon them, and they all prophesied. But it was sort of like Acts of the Old Testament, the day of Pentecost. Moses said, and they never did it again. But that was a punctuation, so to speak, that God had come upon them. And then when the temple was destroyed in the 6th century B.C., then the synagogue was started, then the office of ruling elder became more and more dominant. It was carried over into the New Testament church, and that's how we ended up with a Presbyterian government. Now, there have been basically three types of polity over the years. Episcopal polity is a rule of bishops. Episcopal comes from the Greek word episkopos, which means bishop. And that originated very early. In the middle of the 2nd century, you had the rise of the episcopacy. So both Presbyterianism and episcopacy have deep historical roots. On the other end of the spectrum, you have Congregationalism, which is very popular here in America because we like individualism. And the Puritans who came to New England were Congregationalists. There is the first congregational government we find is not in the 1st century, but the 16th century. But it became very popular. Presbyterianism is sort of in between the two. We have plural elders, so I see at least three here, that lead the church, the people. So in that way, it's an in-between system between episcopacy and congregationalism. Now, this is a pendulum. So it swings back and forth. Now, remember when you were ordained, you're studying for your ordination. One of the ordination vows was, do you approve of the government and discipline of the Presbyterian Church in America as being in conformity with the general principles of biblical polity? When you think about it, in the Bible, there's not a lot of detail about polity. So we have developed that over the years. And one of the things that happens is there's a pendulum swing, and then we react against our history and our experience. The Presbyterian Church in America was started because we had the same experience that other Christians had in all mainline denominations. Now, in the Trinity hymnal, there's a tune. The name of the tune is Darwall. But it is used for several hymns. The one you probably know the best is Rejoice the Lord is King. Rejoice the Lord is King. Da 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 dum da dum. But it's used for several hymns in the Trinity hymnal. Now, the tune that all evangelical Christians and mainline Protestant denominations have sung over the last 100 years, it's the same tonal pattern, and it has a 3-note pattern. Theological and ethical decline. Church becomes liberal and adopts secular ethics, particularly sexual ethics. The second note in the tune is the lack of accountability, so that those who should be held accountable are not held accountable, and those who try to hold them accountable are persecuted. And then the third note in the tune is the abuse of ecclesiastical power. Now, the interesting thing is, in all these denominations, It doesn't matter what the confessional theology is or what form of church government you have. It has all been the same common experience. Any system can be abused. So, in the previous denomination, the evangelical churches had lost confidence in the seminaries who had become neo-Orthodox, and the Christian education materials, the Sunday school materials, the Covenant Life curriculum was teaching neo-Orthodoxy, sort of a blend of liberalism and existential philosophy or experience, how you feel. So it was a blending of liberalism and feeling. So they wouldn't contribute to the Christian education or the seminaries. The last bastion of evangelicalism was the Foreign Mission Board. So evangelical churches would designate their money to missions. Well, the previous denomination had what was called a General Executive Board, and they had the authority to move money around. So the General Executive Board would take money that had been given to missions, and then they would fund the seminaries and the Christian education program. Well, we were sure that is never going to happen in the PCA. So when we set up the PCA, we began with four committees and agencies. Now, think of these as silos, because they are. That's what they are. We have a rule in our rules of assembly operation that it is impossible to take money from one agency to the other without that agency's permission. So if you send a check to our office and say, distribute this according to the formula, what was called the partnership chair formula, approved by the General Assembly, then I have to do exactly what that formula is. I can't deviate at all from that. Now, part of our problem also is, I'm the coordinator of the administrative committee as well. So for many people, administration is a four-letter word. I serve on the board of World Relief, which is obviously a Christian relief organization. We received a gift from the Willow Creek Church in Illinois, you've heard of that church, for $1 million for aid relief, the AIDS relief in Africa. There are a lot of AIDS orphans and widows. But the stipulation was not a penny of this $1 million can be used for administration. How are you going to get the money to the people? How are you going to provide the services? So the president of World Relief had to go ask some individual donors for about $100,000, $150,000 to be able to administer and distribute that million. Well, we did something very strange. We made administration a separate ask. So that was one of the four silos that was first established. So we have administration. We had what is now Mission to North America, Mission to the World, what is now Committee on Discipleship Ministries. But they were set up as four silos established by the General Assembly. But there's not a coordinated oversight of these silos, other than the individual reports to the General Assembly. Now, other things were later spun off. Retirement benefits was spun off from the Administrative Committee as that ministry grew. Then the PCA Foundation also was spun off from the Administrative Committee as that Foundation, ministry group. Ridgehaven Conference Center actually is out of sequence here, but that was given to us early on, and that became a separate entity. Then in 1982, when the Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod merged into the PCA, we inherited Covenant College and Covenant Seminary. Now, the way this works is the General Assembly elects the members of the permanent committees and boards of the agencies. So we have five committees and five agencies. So the General Assembly elects all of these people to serve on these boards. So those committees and boards meet several times a year. They each have a paid staff and a coordinator or a president, and they do that work. But again, because of the pendulum swing, we want to be sure that nobody's doing anything incorrectly. So we have committees of commissioners at the General Assembly, and they report to the General Assembly the actions of the committees and agencies. They meet usually from 2 to 12 hours, depending on the complexity of the work and the controversy involved. So they then report to the General Assembly. Now, the strength of a system is also its greatest weakness. Remember World War II history is something I like to think of because I was born at the end of the war. Admiral Nimitz was a very aggressive fighter. I mean, he wanted to ruin the Japanese Navy. So the Japanese used that in one of the battles to lure him away by putting a decoy convoy of ships to the north, and he went steaming off to get them so then they could send in another group of ships from the south. So his greatest strength, his aggressiveness, was also his weakness. That's also true in every one of these systems of polity. The greatest strength is the greatest weakness. So in the Presbyterian system, we have the plurality of elders. There's wisdom in many counselors. That's a strength. It's also a weakness. Some sessions have the idea that, well, we want to be unanimous on things. So you may have 12 elders and one guy just won't cooperate. He's a stick in the mud. He opposes everything. But if you have that unanimous consent rule, I mean, that can stop it dead in its tracks. So that is a weak. Another strength of the Presbyterian system is the ability to take a controversy to a broader church and a higher court. Now, our office also handles the records and performs support services for the Standing Judicial Commission. And I'll have to tell you that the majority of cases we get, we should never have. I can't change the Book of Church Order by fiat. I can't. But if I could, there would be two rules I would institute. Well, actually three. One rule is that the Standing Judicial Commission will accept no case that involves a contested divorce. Why? If someone is willing to take their divorce to the General Assembly, they don't want justice, they want revenge. The second one would be the Standing Judicial Commission will accept no case where a person has been imposed a civil restraining order. We have people that Sessions have had to get restraining orders because of their raucous and threatening behavior, or even bringing guns to the church and threatening people. We shouldn't be taking cases like that. And the other one was, I had a fellow who had a psychiatric problem, and he was cursing out people at church, and the session was going to discipline him. His psychiatrist said, well, he's under my care. He really can't offer a reasonable defense, but they excommunicated him anyway. Well, after about a year of counseling and medication, he was rational. He came back and he apologized and they restored him. So then he called me up. He said, you know, you need a rule in the Book of Church Order. I said, what kind of rule? He said, you need a nutcase rule. He said, when I was doing all this stuff, I was out of my mind. And there was no way I could offer a defense. And you need a rule that would put such cases on the back burner until there's some psychiatric resolution. But I can't change a Book of Church Order, so I don't. Now, in Presbyterianism, we have some assemblies are delegated and some are non-delegated. This General Assembly, we will have about 1,300 commissioners. We had 1,252 last night. We'll have some late registration, so we'll end up about 1,300 members. How many members of the House of Representatives, United States Congress? 452? Is that right? 435. And 100 senators. So that's the total is 535. We're at least twice that size of the entire United States Congress. So that makes it difficult to deal as a deliberative body. But because conservatives were shut out of becoming commissioners to the General Assembly in the older church, former church, we started with a non-delegated assembly. We tried to go to a delegated assembly several times in the early years. Do any of you remember Jimmy Lyons? Okay, you remember a few guys. He's now with the Lord. But he was a advocate of missions. He was on the staff of Mission to the World, and he would go around and promote missions at missions conferences. But he was quite a character. Was he a Cherokee Indian or Creek? All right, he was a Cherokee Indian. And we were talking about having a general assembly, a delegated general assembly, one of the early assemblies. I've been to every assembly. And Jimmy Lyons got up and said, I never got to be a commissioner of the General Assembly in the old church. And if anybody ever tells me that I can't come to the General Assembly, I'm going to punch him in the nose. Well, after Jimmy Lyons' punch in the nose speech, the idea of a delegated assembly was gone. Other denominations, like the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, they have a delegated assembly of 150. Which, by the way, is delegated to have more teaching elders than ruling elders because they can't get enough ruling elders to come. But we were talking, I was in our interchurch relations committee. That's one part of my job is interchurch relations. We were talking with the OPC about possibilities of merger, and they said, you know what the problem with the PCA is? I said, well, I think so, but you tell me. You do not have a deliberative body of the General Assembly. I said, you know, you're right. We don't. What we have is a self-delegating assembly surrounded by a convention. So what happens is, on the first night, the place will be full because we're going to elect the moderator. And then when there are controversial issues or watershed issues, like the report of the nominating committee, the hall fills up. Or if there's a controversial issue coming up, the hall fills up. But other times, it empties. People are all playing golf, they're at the bookstore, they're in the exhibit hall, taking their family out to eat or whatever, and then it fills up again when something controversial comes. So because we couldn't get a delegated assembly, we ended up with a hybrid. We have the Overtures Committee is a delegated assembly within the assembly. And in the Overtures Committee, where most of the controversial stuff comes, you have one ruling elder and one teaching elder from each of the 83 presbyteries. So it's delegated. But even then, we can't get as many ruling elders as teaching elders. And then they report to the assembly as a whole. So we have a delegated assembly surrounded by the non-delegated assembly. So that will come up on Thursday when the Overtures Committee reports. Now, I went to a Christian college, and we had what we call the Seniors Candlelight Service. And we would meet in the chapel, and they'd turn out the lights, and everybody would have candles, you know, this little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine type of thing. And each senior would get up and say what they're going to do after graduation and what the ministry they hope to have. And what is your life's verse? So you had to choose a verse that you thought would be descriptive of your life. Mine was from 1 Timothy, I thank God who's counted me faithful and thrust me into the ministry. But if Presbyterians had a life's verse, it would be 1 Corinthians 14:40. Let all things be done decently and in order. You know, denominations choose their names by what's important to them. Why do Baptists call themselves Baptist? Because of their view on baptism. Believer's baptism only, immersion only. That's why they call themselves Baptist. We call ourselves Presbyterians because of the form of government that we have, which is collegial eldership and representative government. So that's important to us. Now, because we have our life's verse, it's 1 Corinthians 14:40, we love order. Now, of course, the Bible is our supreme authority. But the Bible doesn't tell you the difference between a committee and a commission. And the Bible doesn't say anything about study committees and how many people should be on the study committee and how long the study committee should last and how it should be. It doesn't say any of that. So we have a hierarchy of rules. The first that trumps everything, this is the trump card, this is the rook card, it is the PCA Constitution. And that is the Book of Church Order and the Westminster Larger Confession, Larger Catechism, and Shorter Catechism. So we may not do anything that's contrary to the Constitution. Then secondly, we have the Rules of Assembly Operation. Those are the goldenrod pages in the Book of Church Order. So that we have some rules on how the General Assembly operates. And then that would be, if you remember how to play rook, this would be like this is the rook card, the Constitution, the Rules of Assembly Operation would be the trump one. And then the Trump 14 would be the Roberts Rules of Order. Now, I know we're a national church, but we originated in the South. So, no offense intended, and with all due respect. Have you ever noticed when someone says that it's usually a offensive and disrespectful comment. no offense intended, and all due respect to our brothers north of the Mason-Dixon line. The Robert's Rules of Order was developed by a Union general, Henry M. Robert. He was a ruling elder in a congregational church in New England. And the session meetings and congregational meetings were so raucous that he began to develop rules on how that should happen. Now, he stole some rules from the British Parliament and the United States Congress, but he also came up with his own rules. So Robert's Rules of Order was originally written to keep ruling elders from church members from being raucous. Now, one of my former ruling elders, Sam Duncan, when I was pastor at First Church in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, likes to travel, and he sent me a picture of a little brick building behind a Presbyterian church in South Carolina. And it was called the Session House. And the way that got built was these Scots-Irish Presbyterians, you know, Scots-Irish folk like to fight. And their session meetings often ended in fist fights. So they decided, you know, this really is not appropriate for us to be having fist fights in the church building. So the solution was they built a separate building for their session meetings, so they got a fight. So rules are important. The more controversial a subject is, and the more emotionally laden a subject is, that is why rules are important. Now, it always makes me nervous when people disparage rules, because that's my job, is to know the rules and apply the rules. All right. Now, what are the major issues that are coming up this year? We have the issue of racial reconciliation that was carried over from the last assembly and given to the presbyteries and asked them to express their opinion. And the presbyteries did. We have 66 overtures, and over 40 of them have to do with racial reconciliation. In the 19th century especially, there was, particularly among Southern Presbyterians, a doctrine of the spirituality of the church. And that, simply put, was the church should not be involved in political issues, only spiritual issues. Major premise. Minor premise. Chattel slavery is a political issue. Conclusion. Therefore, the church should not address chattel slavery. Well, I think the minor premise is incorrect, because the Bible forbids chattel slavery. And you remember in 1 Corinthians and in Revelation and in Romans, where they have this list of kinds of people that won't be in heaven? Murderers, thieves, whoremongers, adulterers, man-stealers. What are man-stealers? Those are people who kidnapped people and sold them into slavery. And then the Old Testament also forbids the buying of people who had been kidnapped into slavery. So In my opinion, our ancestors did not understand that biblical principle properly and misused the scripture on that point. Now, after slavery, you had the Jim Crow laws in the 1890s that were not overturned until the 1960s. But so you have the legacy of slavery, segregation, and then ongoing discrimination. So the church did address the issue of chattel slavery several years ago, but did not address the issue of segregation, discrimination. So that will be coming out of the Overtures Committee, and that will be on Thursday afternoon. And the question is not whether or not we say something, but what are we going to say? So there are three major overtures, one from Missouri, number 4, one from Potomac Presbytery, which is 43, and one from Mississippi Valley, which is 55. So what the Overtures Committee is going to be recommending is to adopt the Potomac Overture and then combine elements of the Missouri and Mississippi Overture with it, and then answer all the other overtures by reference to that recommendation. The second major issue will be the role of women in the PCA. Now, we do not ordain women to be any of the ordained offices, minister, ruling elder, or deacon. There are Presbyterian evangelical denominations, Presbyterian denominations, who do ordain deaconesses. The Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church does. The Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America, Geneva College Group, they have ordained deaconesses because they trace that back to the Reformation, where Calvin had deaconesses in Geneva, and the early church, late 1st century, early 2nd century, where there are records of deaconesses within the church. But this is not dealing with simply the deaconess issue, but what may women do? There's an interplay between the church and a culture. The women's suffrage movement, that women could vote in civil elections, began in the 19th century and culminated in the early 20th century, so women were allowed to vote. Women did not vote in congregational meetings of Presbyterian churches until the 20th century. Now, did the church goad the culture, or did the culture goad the church? Well, some argue it one way, some argue it the other way. So the issue of women's roles and how we can deal with that, use their gifts in the church, is an important issue, and that will come up in the Administrative Committee report, which will be on Thursday. Then the PCA logo. I think I was elected the stated clerk of the General Assembly for two reasons in 1998. One is I come from the middle of the church, what I call the majority middle. There are people to the right of me and people to the left of me, but I come from the majority middle of the church, but I seek to serve the whole church, whether right, left, or middle. And I think the second reason was I had a complete set of all of the minutes of the General Assembly, personal set. Now, a lot of ministers, they get them in the mail and they just toss them or put them in the church library. But I kept mine. And when I retire several years from now, then I'm going to box them all up and I'll give them to the next stated clerk, because he'll be 25 years younger than I, and he will not have been to the General Assemblies, and I have no institutional memory, so I'm going to give him all those minutes. So If you look at the minutes of the first General Assembly, one of the issues that was discussed was a logo, a PCA logo. And that was first sent to Christian Education. They didn't come up with one. It was then sent to the Administration Committee, and it was sent to the Historical Center. And so finally we're getting around to proposing a logo, and you'll have two choices so that you can choose between the two, or you can vote no on both of them and have no logo. But that will come up also under administration. Another is sexual brokenness in a fallen world. I think when we get to heaven, we will see a long line. And I'm going to get into that line. But it's people lined up to talk to Adam. And they're all asking him the same question. What in the world were you thinking? Do you realize the awful mess you got us in when you fell into sin? Now, part of that, so we are all broken people living in a fallen world. And part of that brokenness is sexual brokenness. You know, the Immaculate Conception of Mary is uniquely a Roman Catholic doctrine. I don't mean the virgin birth. I mean Mary's conception. And that is based on the idea that since Adam and Eve fall into sin, it is impossible for people to have sexual relations without concupiscence. That is, some evil desire. Even in the most godly Christian marriage. Except one time. And that was when Mary's parents had relations and she was conceived. And that is the only time since the fall into sin that there was ever a sexual union without concupiscence. And that's how they explain that Mary had no sin nature. Now, of course, we reject that idea. But we're all sexually broken. And one of the ways that is expressed is through same-sex attraction. Now, obviously, we do not endorse same-sex marriage, and we don't endorse promiscuity, heterosexual or homosexual. We believe the biblical principle is fidelity within heterosexual marriage of one man to one woman, or chastity for all of the unmarried. But what do you do with people who have these types of attractions? Several years ago, one of our young ministers, when we were discussing the issue of homosexuality on the floor of the assembly, one of our young ministers got up. And I thought that this was since I've been to every General Assembly, I thought this was a watershed moment in the history of the PCA. This young man stood up and said, "I have struggled with same-sex attraction ever since puberty. By the grace of God, I and the mentoring of a godly counselor, I am able to deal with that. And I'm now married to a woman, and we have a child." Now, we're going to have a seminar, an assembly-wide seminar, right after this. There'll be three participants. One of them will be that young man. And the second one will be his counselor, Tim Geiger, who helped him through that struggle. And the third one will be David Strain, pastor of First Presbyterian Church of Jackson, Mississippi, who has dealt with people who have that struggle in his pastoral ministry. I don't think 10 years prior to that, that anyone would have had the courage to stand up to the General Assembly and make that admission. So I think that's a sign of the maturity of the PCA, that we're willing to deal with things pastorally. So that seminar will be coming up immediately. Then the issue also of religious liberty. There's an overture from Grace Presbytery, come up in the Overtures Committee, on since churches, evangelical churches, do not endorse same-sex marriage, to petition the government to ensure that evangelicals will be able to have religious liberty. Frankly, I don't know if that'll do much good. Several years ago, when the president did away with the don't ask, don't tell policy in the military, there was an overture that I write the president and express our opinion and urge him to continue the don't ask, don't tell. Now, the address of the state clerk's office is 1700 North Brown Road, Lawrenceville, Georgia. So I spent hours working on this letter to the president. And then I sent it to the White House. I got a note card back. The note card said, "Dear Dr. Brown, thank you for expressing your opinion to the president, and he will take your views into consideration in making his decisions. Cordially, the White House." So, we may pass the overture, but I'm not very optimistic that it will do a whole lot of good. All right, are there questions? Yeah.
I know that there's slight differences with the RAO and how things are run. What would you say are the coming from somebody who's familiar with how PCA works in the session and the presbytery? What are kind of three main differences in how things operate?
Okay. Remember the trump card. All right. Here's the rook. Here's the one. Here's the 14. Under Robert's rules, you may have standing rules that trump Robert's rules. So if there's a conflict between Robert's and the rules of assembly operation, then the rules of assembly operation trump Robert's. So there are some differences. Calling the question, you know, where you want to end debate. Okay, let's quit talking and vote. Well, under Roberts, you cannot do that in a committee. But you could do that in a larger assembly. But we have a rule that in our hybrid system, you could do that in the Overtures Committee. You could do it in the General Assembly, and you could do it in the Overtures Committee. You can't do it in committee commissioners. In the General Assembly, it would take a two-thirds vote, because that's what Robert says. But under the RAO, under overtures, since that's our hybrid system of a delegated assembly within the non-delegated assembly, we said you can call the question, but it has to be a three-fourths vote. So there are some differences there, and there's some other differences on who gets the last word in a debate. In our case, the chairman of a permanent committee at the end of debate gets to have the last word. So there are some differences. Yes?
I've got a question pertaining to teaching elders, ruling elders. It being a given that we progressively less and less and less participation for whatever reason.
Yeah.
From teaching elders, from ruling elders, and a vast majority of teaching elders.
Right.
How do you see that affecting the PCA?
Well, there are pluses and minuses. With all due respect, and no offense intended, some churches have an officer training period that is 6 weeks. Sometimes others are up to a year. But a minister studies for 3 years at seminary. I think it is unrealistic to expect that a ruling elder would have the same level of knowledge of the items required for ordination than a minister would. I used to be a seminary professor, and in my opinion, if a guy who went through seminary for 3 years and he didn't know any more than what he could learn in a 6 weeks officer training course, then he really didn't pay much attention in seminary. I think that the positive benefit is that ministers would know the theology and polity better. But any system can be abused. The system works for those who work the system. And we have seen that numerous times in the General Assembly. I think that the lower level of ruling elders is not a good thing in many respects, because it lowers the role of those who live and work in the workaday world. Now, I realize the problems. When I was in First Hattiesburg, we had 25 elders. And when I went there, it was very difficult to get ruling elders to go to Presbyterian General Assembly, particularly physicians. I had a number of physicians and lawyers who worked on billable hours, and business owners who are thinking of the bottom line. So they would go to Presbytery and they would be thinking in terms of cost per hour and man hours, you know, ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. And there would be debates on punctuation marks and minutia. And they would think, this is a waste of my time. And so they wouldn't go back. So we found several ruling elders. They were usually either lawyers or accountants or engineers. Now, what's the common denominator? They like details. They like structure. And so instead of rotating it around among the 25, we just said, these guys will be our cadre of men that will go to Presbyterian General Assembly. And eventually one of them, Sam Duncan, was elected moderator of the General Assembly. So I think that it would be wise to have a similar procedure, to not require that every ruling elder participate in Presbyterian General Assembly, but there would be some from your church, so that there would be that Presbyterian General Assembly wouldn't just be a meeting of the preachers' union. Yes. That's true.
How do I best prepare?
All right. The way to be involved, I think, is, of course, to attend. Be mentored by somebody else, your pastor, if he's experienced and older, or some other elder. You get to send two elders, if you wish, ruling elders. And read the commissioner's handbook, but I wouldn't read all of it. I mean, look at it. It's 6 inches thick. I would read the reports that of which you're most interested, and the but particularly the recommendations. Now, frankly, the recommendations of the General Assemblies and agencies are usually follow this script. Please look at all the great things we're doing. Please give us your financial support. And in the sense of the agency and the committees, please re-elect our coordinator for another term. Those are usually what, that's the usual script. So, but then look for things beyond those three items. So as you read the report, look at the recommendations to look beyond those three things. Serving on committee of commissioners can be very helpful because you get to see the minutes of the firm of committee or agency, what they've been doing throughout the year, and then observe the process of seeing what's going on. So I read through all the reports, but that's unrealistic to expect 1,300 people to read every page of a 6-inch thick notebook. So I would read selectively and discerningly. Yes.
Sir.
Yes, sir.
We've got these five issues you discussed.
Yeah.
Race, women, sexual brokenness, religious liberty, and local, I think.
Right.
Once these are brought up and voted, if any or all one or two of these are voted down, what is the protocol in the future? Do they bring them, can they be brought up again in the same format?
They could be brought. It depends on the issue. One assembly does not bind another assembly. The only way, there are only two ways to change things permanently. When you get back to the hierarchy of rules. There are only two ways to do that. One is to amend the rules of assembly operation, which we do every year, or the other is to amend the Constitution. We amend the Book of Church Order almost every year. We have never amended the Westminster Standards, which I hope we don't. But there are only two ways to make it permanent, is to enshrine that in a rule change of the RAO or the BCO. All right, it's time for us. No, we have two more minutes. Is there not one more question? Yeah.
You suggested three things that you would change if you had the
power. Yeah.
Given our current system, how would you go about that to make those changes?
Oh, well, I do not expect those changes to be made. But what I could try, though I'm sure it would not pass, I would go to the presbytery and I would propose. I would go to my presbytery and I would propose changes to the manual of the Standing Judicial Commission, which is approved in the same way of the Rules of Assembly Operation, that requires a 2/3 vote of the commissioners present, which must be 1/2 of the enrollment that for that given year. That's what I would do, but I have no realistic expectation that would be approved. So, in some cases, if you can't win, don't play is a wise thing. So, I don't think I can win, so I'm not going to play on those. You had a question?
Yes, sir. I was going to ask the board, where is the direction of the BCA bar for the growth? Are we in a stable growth now? Or
the mainline denominations are shrinking, the liberal ones. Some of the evangelical denominations are plateaued or declining, like the Southern Baptist Convention. Used to have 17 million, now they have 15 million. Their record of professions of faith is going down. We have had only 1 year of decline when one of our large multi-thousand member churches left to go to another denomination. In the early years, we had some spectacular growth when you consider that on a percentage-wise basis. Presently, we are growing modestly, but not as spectacularly as in the early years. And that primarily is coming through church planting and church renewal. Yes.
Are our church finally particularized church plants?
Yeah.
It was a real joy to be able to give to the administration and the AC committee and all that. And I think it might be good to just give a pitch again. Why is it important for our church to support the denomination, even that modest amount financially?
Well, the fact of the matter is half the churches in the PCA don't give anything to any General Assembly ministry, which I think is very sad. The genius of Presbyterianism is that we are connectional church. We are not independent churches. We are interdependent churches. So when we support the ministries of the denomination, we are expressing our theology, our ecclesiology, that we are a connectional church. And all of the committees and agencies have varied ministries, some which are much more attractive than others. When you go to a session meeting and you have a request to support a church planter or a missionary or a campus minister, and then you also have a request from RBI to contribute to the fund for retired ministers and widows, and then you have a request from administration to support us, what are you going to do? You're going to give priority to the church planters, missionaries, and campus ministers. You may give to the widows, and if you have anything left, you might give to administration. But we are the cohesive unit and the corporate structure and the infrastructure of the PCA. Okay, it's time for us to quit, so let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for your grace and mercy. We pray that you will bless us now as we go to this assembly-wide seminar, and we pray that it would be a benefit to us. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.